and please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Richie from the Wholesale Miracles Group in Wayne, New Jersey.
Hi, everybody. My name is Richie. I'm definitely an alcoholic.
Hey, Richie.
And my sobriety date is October 24th, 1996. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I sponsor a bunch of other people. Is it okay if I move the microphone?
Yes.
That's cool, right? Hi, Zoom people. I almost forgot that they were there, and then I saw the computer. And thank you for asking me to come and speak and to share with you guys. I was told by my sponsorship lineage, my group, you know, what we're supposed to do when we come up is share what it was like, what happened, and what we're like now and how we live now. Lenny, I got sober on Staten Island, New York is where I got sober, and some guy, Lenny, from there, used to wear his big cowboy hat, which is a little out of place for a place like Staten Island, New York. And Lenny used to come up, and when every time anybody asked Lenny to share, Lenny said, I drank too much too often for too long, and now let's talk about recovery. And he'd spend the whole meeting just talking about the 12-step recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like that, and I'd prefer to spend the whole meeting just talking about my recovery. Well, that might not be a whole true, because I like a war story here and there, too. But my sponsor told me that I don't get to do that for qualification purposes, for the newcomer. Right? Everything we do is for the newcomer. And even for anybody who's around to see, when we're going to tell you what it's like now, sometimes it's helpful to see what it was like for that person who's sharing you their story, so you know that they know the game. You know, I'm as sick as they come, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. I don't know if anybody here has ever come to an AA meeting and heard somebody share, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. God, I hated when people said that stuff when I first came into this place. Matter of fact, I hated you. I hated these meetings. Did not want to come here. Did not want to be here. Did not have an epiphany. Not one of those people who, you know, all of a sudden one day woke up and said, I've got to go to AA and I need to get clean. That's not my experience, not my story. Before I get there, I'm just going to back it up a little bit and I'm going to tell you, I didn't have my first drink when I'll tell you what I didn't. I didn't have my first drink when I was 5 years old on my grandfather's lap and all of a sudden I felt like I wasn't alone in the universe. None of that stuff happened for me. I never felt alone in the universe. I didn't like the taste of alcohol when I was a little kid. I hated it, as a matter of fact. You're going to hear me talk a little bit. I don't talk about drugs specifically in an AA meeting. I won't do it because it's against tradition. I'm not going to talk about crawling around on the floor at 3 a.m. and crushing a plasterboard and snorting it. None of you people even know what I was talking about, right? So I'm not going to talk specifically about that stuff. Drugs are a part of my story, and I mentioned that because Bill mentioned it in Bill's story in our big book that he was drinking and doing high-powered sedatives, and that combination soon landed him on the rocks and people feared for his sanity, and that's my story. And Dr. Bob mentions that he also, Bill and Bob, our co-founders, they were crackheads in the 1920s. Bottom line, both of them were taking high-powered shit, drinking Dilaudid. They were absolutely out of their minds. It's probably why I identify with them so much, and I thank God that our founder and co-founder were as whacked out as I was. And they really were the people who founded this program. So anyway, I do have drugs is a part of my, a little bit is a part of my story. And I won't talk specifically about it, but it's important for, again, identification purposes. So everybody, you know, you're not alone. There's lots of stuff that goes on in AA, but I try and stick to my drink. And God knows I've got plenty of that in my story and in my history. And so, but I didn't like the booze when I was a little kid. And so all my friends, you know, it's a fit-in thing, right? Like, I'm a human being, and I have the human condition that I suffer from. And I always wanted to fit in, and I always wanted to be a part of, and I want to be part of the guys. I'm one of the guys. You know what I mean? I'm one of the guys. And the guys are going to get 40s of Budweiser, and I'm going to get a 40 with them. Or we're going to go drink by the trees in the woods. And so they would all get their 40s, and I'd go buy a 42. And it was nasty shit. I hated Budweiser back then. I grew in love with it, but I hated it back then. But I would go, and I would open my 40, and while everyone was drinking, I'd pour it out behind me, you know, so when nobody saw it. And so they'd think I drank the, because I want to fit in. I want to be a part of. But I was no prude. I was tripping on mescaline at the time. You know what I mean? The kids I grew up, we were messed up. I was whacked out of my brain. But I just didn't like the booze. You know what I mean? But all the drugs, I fell into that real early. And then when I turned about 16, 17, that's when I fell in love with alcohol. I like drinking games. And they started, I'm a competitive kid, and I fell into drinking games, and I became every drinking title that you've ever heard of. I probably got it. I failed out of, you know, some decent colleges, and I went and tried to get my friends to fail out of theirs, and I never did graduate, and My brothers and sisters all did. I'm the black sheep. If there's anybody in here who's a black sheep of your family, that's me. I'm the black sheep of my family. My mother, God bless her, she's cursed one time in her whole life. She's not much on profanity, my mom. She just does not curse. And she cursed once. She told me to get the fuck out of her mom's house. I'm the only person reason she ever cursed once in her life. It was the F curse, and it was at me. And that's not awesome. You know, once I did start drinking, I was introduced at a pretty young age. Once I drank for 3 years, like you read about. I'm a hider. Does anybody hide booze? I'm a booze hider. I hide it always. I always have. From the very beginning, I would hide bottles of Jack Daniels in my closet throughout my house. I hid beers on every family. We just had family holiday, and my family still laugh, and they bring it up, that I would hide Meisterbrowers inside the turkey carcass. They would save it for soup the next day, right? This is the bone, they'd use the bones, and I would hide a couple of Meisterbrow up inside of the bird so nobody got all the beers at 4 o'clock in the morning. I share this stuff identification-wise because I'm an alcoholic, and I had the mind of an alcoholic before I even crossed that magic, invisible line. Maybe somebody here will identify with it. My dad was a fireman, and he came home from work one day, and he brought a couple of, there was, I guess, a liquor store fire that they put out, and, you know, that all sorts of stuff would find their way into the back of the fire truck back in the day when you could kind of get away with that. My father brought home, which was then top shelf alcohol, Absolut vodka. I know now Absolut's garbage, apparently, and it's like the low end, but it used to be. There was a time where Absolut was the best of the best. Everyone drank Gordon's and, like, you know, cheap stuff. That was my dad, and he brought home fancy bottles of Absolut vodka. So my father brought him home into the house, and he went into our kitchen. I remember seeing him bring it out. I'm like, ooh, that's Absolut. And my father ain't going to drink it, not in a million years. And I was 17 at the time, and you're allowed to drink in my house. My house was CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholics, you know, and you could drink in my house. As long as you didn't do any drugs, you were okay. So even at a young age, I was allowed to drink. And my dad came, and he put the vodka where we, in a particular cabinet in our kitchen, where we would keep like the Canadian Mist and the Frangelica. Does anybody have any of those? I love those cabinets. Most people have Sambuca, stuff you only drink with the old people. Once in a while, you put it out at dessert. My father put the two bottles there. Now, I told you already, I'm duly addicted, and so, you know, non-conference approved dry goods, the white stuff later, I got that introduced as part of my story, but I am one of those, and if you can identify with this, even the straight drunk sometimes can, I can hear, I have superpowers. I know every drawer in my house that I grew up in, that if you opened a particular drawer, I know the squeak and the sound of it. If I had just stolen money out of my father's nightstand, I would know from the living room if I needed to clear out because I could hear them opening particular drawers. I had a superpower, and I also had good peripheral vision. So I could just be sitting here, but I'm really watching everything they're doing because I got to see where they're going to put the thing or where my mom's going to put her purse. It became such a sickness and a superpower that I developed. And so anyway, my dad put it in that particular creaky cabinet in the kitchen. And so one day they went, not too long after that, they were away, my whole family, and it's rare that I would have the house to myself. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to have one, it'd be rude not to have one of those bottles of Absolut. And I'm allowed to have it. I don't have to sneak it. I was 17, I'm allowed to drink it. So they were gone, and so I opened it up, and I did that. I drank it in a night. And so I was up all night and whatever, partying, and I drank a bottle of Absolut vodka. It's really not that big of a deal. We did shit like that all the time. When I was younger, I drank a lot. And when I was done with the alcohol, I passed out that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I went into the kitchen, and so what would a normal person do? Clean up after themselves and throw it out. What did I do? Half the alkies in here are like, you filled it up with water. Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Why? I didn't need to fill it up with water. I could literally have thrown it out. My father would open it and said, oh, somebody drank the vodka. He probably would have said, Richard drank the vodka, but whatever. He would have said, somebody drank the vodka. I could do it. But I didn't. I pulled the other bottle out. I filled it up with water so they would be exactly the same. I used to do that with pill bottles and stuff. I rearranged the pill bottle and put it exactly where I got it. So I put it back. And then that night, my parents were away for the weekend. Now it's Saturday. Be rude not to. So I drank the second bottle of Absolut vodka. And I did the repeat process. Sunday morning, I woke up and I filled that one up with water. And there I left the Absolut. And my dad, who would never drink those Absolut vodka bottles in a million years, don't know what made him do it. He was an alky. My father would drink the Georgie vodka. I don't know if anybody had parents who would drink vodka out of coffee cups in the middle of the day, because you can't see what they're drinking in a coffee cup, but I know the routine, and I'm in the living room, and it's the summer, I'm laid out on the couch, and I hear the ice crunch, and I go, oh, Hop's gonna have a drink. And I hear clunk, clunk, and I hear the ice cubes hit the, and I know the ice cubes are in the cup now, and then I hear the squeak, and I'm like, no! The Georgie cabinet doesn't squeak! And I'm like, oh my God, there's no way, there's no way! And I hear him open it, and I hear glug, glug, glug. Now you got a choice to make, you know, do I get out of there, off the couch, slip outside, or do I just pretend I don't know what he's talking about, because inevitably it's gonna go down, and I just pretended I didn't want to move, and I just laid there and pretended I was gonna just feign ignorance. And so my father, I hear him sit down, and I hear him with his paper, and I hear, what the fuck? And I hear, fuck, and he walks over, and I hear the cabinet open, and I hear him unscrew the first one, and then I hear him unscrew the second, God damn it! And I hear him unscrew both, and he comes out to the living room, directly to me. I got four brothers and sisters, a full house in my house. He came directly out to me, and said, what's wrong with you? Screaming at me. And it was a good question. What's wrong with me? I could have drank both bottles of that vodka. Think about that. I love to tell that story because alcoholics will understand what I mean, and other people are like, I get it. I was hiding it before it even became a problem, because I knew. There was a part of me that knew it was a problem, that I was already drinking problematically. Nothing had gone horribly wrong in my life yet, and already I was trying to minimize and hide and show not show people what I was doing, even when I was allowed to. And that's where this sickness, I see it now. I didn't realize at the time how insane that really was. And my brain got more and more insane as it went on. That was the least of it, right? But that's just kind of shows the peculiar mental twist, those strange blank spots, the things I would do to hide or control my drinking from others. From there, it took off. My bodily and mental health fell off like a ski jump. Somebody introduced me to non-AA conference-approved dry goods, cocaine, and the two of those got married and never to be divorced. They love and hate each other and beat each other to death daily. And they were married for quite some time, and they'll never, ever be divorced. And so that was just a train ride to unbelievable. And so I could tell you 1,000 stories about all the stuff I stole. I'm the guy who I'd come knock on my mom's door, and you'd hear the chain, and you'd hear, what? 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 That's who I am. I'm the what? Chain on the door, what? That's who I am to my mom. It's sad, you know, because I grew up in a house that wasn't like that. I was, again, a black sheep. I was an oddity to my family. It's amazing that one of us actually went that far off the reservation where no one would let me in their house except for my brother. My brother was the only one who let me stay. Everyone else I was kicked out of. I'd stolen from all of them. None of them would let me in their homes. And I don't blame them. They were smart, you know. And my brother just, you know, loved me. I was his bro. And so he let me stay in some small little closet of a back bedroom in his little apartment. And my brother worked, I guess that's why it worked, but my brother worked on the tugboats. And so he was smart, my brother, and he was like an engineer or whatever. And he'd go away for 3 weeks at a time. He'd be at sea. And I'd have the house all to myself, which is cool, his little tiny apartment. And that poor guy, man, I mean, I used to jimmy the hinges off of his bedroom door, right? First, I used to just break in and steal shit. Then he locked the door with a padlock. Then I jimmied the hinges. Then he was padlocking both sides of his door so I couldn't get in, and I'd come in through the window. Eventually, finally, my brother couldn't take it anymore, what he witnessed and what I did to that poor guy and from everything he did to me. And one day, my brother came home, and my brother told me, you have to go. Oh, you know what? And again, in case there is a newcomer, and this disease, this thing we do, we always try and for everybody here, it's always a reminder for all of us, right? We try and identify and not compare. Alcohol and drugs didn't do to me necessarily what it did to any one of you. Some of you may be a lot worse than me and went further down the path, and that's cool. And some of you might not yet be that far down, and that's okay too, all the better. But I can only tell you my story. I only got one, and it's mine, right? And you can't have mine. And I can just tell you what it did to me. And that final day for me, I stole everything. I told you I've knocked over Christmas trees. I've stolen cars. There's nothing I haven't stolen. There's no degradation. There wasn't anything I wouldn't do for alcohol and drugs. And there's nothing that I didn't do for alcohol and drugs. And then you name the fifth step, humiliating, degradating scenario. And I was there and I did that. That's me. And what it was in the end for me, the last year and a half of my drinking, and using, and I was a big Jack Daniels guy. God, I drink a lot of bourbon. But in the end, it wasn't Jack Daniels anymore. It's funny how that happens. I wasn't going to the bars anymore. I was alone in my apartment. I wasn't drinking Jack Daniels anymore. I was drinking the cheapest, biggest bottle of bourbon I could buy. I wasn't having Jack and Coke anymore, because I'm not buying Coca-Cola Classic. I'm buying Ann Page or ShopRite Cola or whatever, the cheapest. You know what I'm talking about. So all of a sudden, you're buying the cheapest, the American Spirit cigarettes. You're buying the cheapest of everything that you can get. You can't cheap out on the non-AA conference-approved dry goods. I always have to buy, at the beginning of every run, a run for me was 3 days, generally speaking. Sometimes two, but 3 days, generally speaking. I'd have to go meet one of the dealers and get little Valiums, because I know after 3 days, I'm going to be shaken and I need to pass out. And so I would prepare. That's a big part of it for me in the end. I don't know about everybody else. I'm a planner. I like the planning. I like the stealing to get the money for the shit. I like doing that. I know it's insane, but I like the preparation. I like to steal. I like to borrow. I like to beg. I like to go through the window. I like that stuff. It's exciting for me. That's part of the thing, is the prep. Or at least it was for me in the end. And that's how I spent a year and a half, prepping and stealing and getting it ready and going out. And so what I would do is, it became so sick, like the way you would go home after a day of work and you go to ShopRite and you have a little... Well, now they took away our plastic bags, but if let's assume you still had bags, they were paper back then anyway, and you'd come home and you'd check your answering machine and you'd put away your bread and you'd put away your milk and you'd, you know, go about regular life stuff that people do. I would come home from being out, beg, borrow, steal, whatever it was that day to get my money, and I'd come home with a big brown paper bag with that cheap rot gut bourbon and that Ann Page or ShopRite cola, and I'd go right to the back bedroom and I'd put that stuff there in my little bedroom alone in the house, but I'm not going to be anywhere near the living room, and I'll tell you why. I put all that stuff directly in the back bedroom. Then I go in and I go to the kitchen and I get my empty Coke bottles and I put them in there too. Then I go in and I go to the front closet and I get my booby trap box. I put that out and I get ready. I got a whole box filled with booby traps. Then I would get a brown paper bag that I kept up in one of the top shelves, put it in my back pocket, run out the door. I'd run down to the local 7-Eleven where they sold beer. On the way down there, I'd stop at two other delis. This was a normal thing for me. It was every day. I knew exactly the spots to go. I'd have the brown paper bag open and I'd go and hit the two delis, always little ashtray cans up front. And I would go to the gutters and I would pick up quarter and half smoked cigarettes. You're going to need it. Oh my God. After 2 days when you run out of cigarettes, if you're smart, you're collecting half smoked ones. And I'd go around and collect a big paper bag full. The 7-Eleven was like, it was a holiday. Unbelievable how many stupid people light up a cigarette and then say, oh, I got to go to 7-Eleven, and they throw it out. It's like almost full. And you'd find it. You'd be like, yes. Right? Think about that, right? 25 years old, and I'm going, yes, because I'm finding a three-quarter smoked Marlboro. It's a win. And that was, life is good, you know what I mean? You're a sicko because you're identifying with me. It tells me about you. But I am. I have, you know, that's a big day. And so I would gather all that stuff, and then I'd inevitably buy a tall boy, and I'd drink it in the corner of the 7-Eleven parking lot watching the people walk by. Remember, everything I've told you, I haven't had a drink yet. My first drink, I just took my first tall boy. And then I go back to the house and I empty my cigarettes onto a Jethro Tull album I had just for that very occasion. I'd line them all up in size order by brand. Marlboro, Marlboro Light, Parliament, Winston, Pall Mall, you name it. And I'd line them all up by size and brand. It's sick. And I'm preparing to get high. I'm preparing to drink. Now the bourbon starts. And I started because I already had the beer. Now I start with the bourbon. And as I start with the bourbon, I'm going and I'm booby trapping everything. Because I know 5, 6, 8 hours from now, they're going to be coming. And I'm going to be prepared while I'm still sober. So I'd put beer on every single handle knob in the thing. I'd put a beer bottle. I had one for every knob in the entire apartment. So if you turned it, I got you. Mops I had to lean against all the doors. I had sheets that perfectly fit the windows. I had towels already pre-rolled for the bottoms of the doors. I prepped. I put chairs on all the doors. I'm still not even high or even drunk. I just had my first bourbon. And then I get everything booby-trapped, and I go into the back bedroom, and I put a chair up against that door. No more TV. That was back a year earlier, where I would watch TV, and I would listen to the radio, and then eventually turn it off to listen. Now I don't even bother with that for the last year plus. You can't put that shit on at all. And I know at some point I'm going to end up naked with porn magazines, so I just start that way, right? In the end, you just go in there, you just start that way. And then it's 2, 3 days, however long I can last. And doesn't it sound like fun? All geeked out, hammered, drunk for days, looking out your window by yourself for days. the empty Coke bottles was so I could urinate. Because I'm not going to lift my booby trap to dare to sneak into the bathroom. What if they get me? And so I pee in my room. And then in the end, after I take the Valium and I pass out, I wake up. I'm disgusting. I got to take a shower. I need to eat vinegar. God knows why. I pour out all my pee bottles. I clean them. I'm filthy. I take a shower. And then I get something to eat, shaking. And then eventually I start feeling better. And after 3 or 4 hours, you know, those first 3 or 4 hours are rough. And you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this for a while. Take a break. And then 4 hours later, you're like, ah, you know, let me see who's around. And you go out and you start doing it again and you prep for your next 2 or 3 day run. And that's how I lived for a year. And that's what it did to me. That's where it took me in the end. And then my brother came home. And like I said, I didn't have an epiphany. That's just not how it worked for me. I wish it did. Shit, I would love to tell that story. I wish that was my story sometimes. That I just one day woke up and God showed me like a miracle and said, Richie, you need to be well. And no. God threw buses at me, right? God knew that I needed a bus thrown at me. And so my brother came home one day and he said, I love you and get out of my house. And I was like, seriously? And he's, bro, get out. Pack your stuff. Go. I love you. You cannot stay here anymore. I can't have you here. It was no intervention. It was no coordinated conversation with my parents out of love. They had already cut me off and didn't care what I did. That's just the way my family is. And my brother said, don't care. Get your stuff. Get out. And so I had all my worldly possessions in a big black garbage bag. And I'm standing out in front of my brother's house on Dickey Avenue. And it's weird when maybe people here are smarter than I was, but if you have all your worldly possessions in a black garbage bag and you have no money or bank account, no credit, all destroyed, no job, no car, nothing, you're homeless. Homeless sucks. I don't do homeless. I know people, warriors out here that can do homeless under bridges. I can't do that. I'm a baby. I need a shower. I need a couch. I need a television. I don't do homeless. So I had an epiphany. That was my epiphany. My epiphany was one of, I can't be homeless and I got nowhere to go and none of my family will let me in and I can't even couch surf anymore. So I went to my mom and I knocked on the door and I heard her put the chain on and she said, what? And I said, I think I might have a problem with alcohol and drugs. My mother said, you think so? So she said, okay, Richard. And she undid the door. She let me in her house and she said, sit down. And I went and sat down. And you know what my mom did? And this was for years of when, even before she banned me from the house. And it's one of the things I thought about a lot in early recovery. And it still jerks me up a little bit because I care now and I didn't care then at all. But my mom, when she had brought me in the house, the first thing she would do is get her pocketbook and put it under her arm. And that's how she walked around her home with me in it. If I'm in her home, her pocketbook's under her arm, period. My sisters, she trained them as well. If ever I was invited to a family party before I got fully banned, they would all know where their purses were. That's insane to live like that, but that's just who I was. It's cool. It is what it is. She said, sit. She made a phone call, got me into detox. Detox sucks. And they wanted me to do nothing. No drugs, no alcohol, not even pot. For 7 days in a row. In a row. I hadn't gone 7 days in a row since I was 12. And I'm like, there's no way. 7 days in a row? Newcomers raise their hand to me. He's like, well, I only have 34 days. And I'm like, only 34 days? You're a legend. You were a legend to me. 34 days. The guy's with 9, 10 years. You're full of shit. You don't have 9 years. I don't believe a word you say. The 34-day guy, maybe. I doubt it, but maybe. So, you know, but that's the hope, right? That's what I saw when I saw people with time and I came in. Holy cow, I just didn't believe it. I did the detox and it was brutal. And then I left the front stairs of that detox, man. And I walked out and some people are in that position when they leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There could be somebody who lives in the position tonight where you'll hear stuff you need to hear. You'll identify like I didn't detox. You'll say, I don't want to go back. I don't want to live like that anymore. 7 days in a row, a cloud lifts a little bit. You start thinking like, holy cow, I'm a bum. I got nothing. All my friends have gone on to do things and stuff and families and whatever. And I've done nothing. I have nothing. I'm unemployable. I have no credit. I have a arrest record. I'm everything is terrible. And that's a terrible reality to wake up to. And so I walk out into the front of the detox and I'm standing on the thing and I'm like, I never want to go back to that again. I'm done. I can't drink anymore. I can't use anymore. I need to get help. But at the same token, I wonder who's at the bar. Man, I'm just wondering. And if I paged Marky Bumps, would he page me? Would he call me back? A pager to the young people, it's this little box we used to wear on our belts. And you'd call somebody and they would call you back. It was pretty neat technology back in the day. So I'm standing out on the front stairs of this place. And I've got the devil in one hand saying, just go, just call Marky Bumps, just call Marky Bumps. And the angel was saying, you know, I can never hear anything. It said. And so all I kept hearing was call Marky Bumps. And then one of the techs in there, thank God he had grabbed me and he told me, you're very sick. And he said, and when you leave here, go straight to a meeting. First thing, don't think, go to a meeting. Raise your hand, tell them you're new, and tell them you need help. And I'm telling you, no matter what meeting, first one that's available you go to, but you need to find 12-step meetings. Look for big book people. He said, you're way too sick. You're not going to get so sober any other way. He said, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but I'm in recovery too. I just broke my anonymity. We're not allowed to do it. This guy, Dwight, nice dude. And he said, I'm telling you, you need to seek out 12-step people. You need big book people. You're too sick to get sober any other way. I didn't really know what he meant, but I said, okay, thanks a lot, Dwight. You know, thanks for the great advice. You know, I was such a dick. I really was. I was a dick, no question. So, but anyway, I'm standing there, devil angel, and I said, let me go to an AA meeting. You want to know what my first AA meeting? I got sober in Staten Island. My life's a movie. My whole sobriety is like a movie. It's crazy. Still can't believe it happened to me. So I go to my first meeting, and it's in the middle of the day. It's at noon, and it's filled with old people, like in their 40s. You know what I mean? All these old people in their 40s. And I remember thinking to myself, don't you people work? Right? It's the middle of the day, and they're all in this meeting. Meanwhile, look at me judging. I'm just out of detox. So they're all sitting there. It's a full house. So I didn't know any better. If I would have thought, I would have sat in the back and snuck out early, but I'm, you know, not that bright, and I could walk right into the middle. And I sat right up front, right in the middle of everybody, and I raised my hand and did what Dwight said. And I said, I'm new. I just got out of Bailey's seat and detox. And, you know, they told me to say that I needed help or whatever. And I just looked down at my shoes for the rest of the time. Anybody identify with looking at their shoes? I would never look you in the eye, man. I talked to people. I never looked them in the eye. Such fear I had in my life. And the only time I would look at you is to say, what? What are you looking at? What are you looking at? The 160-pound scary kid that I was. Look at me. Yeah, what are you looking at? You know, because I'm going to intimidate you with my 160 pounds of brawn. But we were, you know, I was mental case. But other than that, I'm looking at my shoes or past you. I can't meet your eye. Certainly can't meet your eye. And so I looked at my shoes. And the rest of the meeting, God, I wish I had a different story sometimes, because I'd love to say again that you guys got me that first meeting and I loved it. But I didn't. I hated it. And all of you. And I went in there and they start raising their hands and they didn't have to, is that crosstalking meeting rules into Pennsylvania or whatever? Do they still have that? I mean, does anybody know what that is? It means that if you share directly, I can't share about what you just shared about. I can't directly talk to you in my share. It's not appropriate. Well, they didn't have that meeting here. And to the young man that just got out of Bailey's seat and detox, I'd like to say blah, blah, blah. And the first couple of people who did it, I'm like, all right, yeah, thank you, thank you. But I'm not that guy. I don't want people talking about me in the meeting. Super uncomfortable. So now, like, 8 people in a row are like, into the guy that just got out of detox. Now I'm thinking, move on, man. And I'm angry. I had rage issues back then. And I'm like, you need to move on. And so now I'm sitting there and I'm pissed off and I can't wait for the meeting to end. And all of them kept it interminably long and they just kept talking about me. And so finally the meeting was over and I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. And then they all, as if I was the speaker, I don't know anything, but they all lined up to come over to tell me good luck. Good luck. Good luck to you, man. And all the guys, they gave me some meeting list with like 18 names on it with phone numbers that I'll never use. Thank you for that, right? Oh, yeah, that's great. I put it in my back pocket. And they're all coming over, and the guys are all Staten Island. All the guys are coming over. They're like, keep coming back, kid. And I'm like this. I'm a personal space guy. I don't want anybody touching me. And so now I'm like, you know, and they're all touching me, and they're all like, good luck, and hitting me in the back. And I'm like, God, I couldn't wait to leave that meeting. And as it's almost over, and I can see the door, the last person saying, peripherally, I told you I have a superpower, I see this one lunatic going back and forth. And I'm like, he's coming to talk to me. There's no question. He's pacing, waiting. I'm like, oh, my God. Sure enough, he comes right over. He goes, hey, kid, kid. And I says, yeah. And he said, you got that meeting list we gave you? And I said, yeah, I got it right here. And he goes, you see the name? Throw it over to the back. He said, you see the name there, Jimmy, with the asterisk? And I said, yeah, I see it. And he goes, that's me, Jimmy. And I said, yeah, all right. Thanks, Jimmy. And he goes, nah, kid, you don't understand. You call that number. And I'm like, whole, you know, mental note, never call Jimmy, right? Because this guy's totally bananas. So I said, yeah, all right, Jimmy, thanks very much. And he goes, nah, kid, I don't think you understand. 2 hours from now, 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, you're going to wake up at 2:00 in the morning, you're going to be dying for a drink. And when you do, you call that number. And I'm like, holy shit. And he's saying it that loud. And he said, I'll tell you something else, kid. If it is 2 o'clock in the morning and my wife answers, you tell that bitch to wake me up. Whoa, Staten Island, not a hotbed. So I never called Jimmy. I'll just, the end of the story, I'll tell you right now, I never called Jimmy. He's not a part of my story in any way, shape, or form. In case you thought he became my sponsor, absolutely not. Having said that, I learned, I don't know if anybody has this experience, I have it all the time. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is a looking back thing. Somebody had said that once, and I registered with it, because it's true. It's a looking back thing. Shit happens to me, and I don't realize how important or significant it is until later. And I look back on it and say, that was a watershed moment, and I didn't know while it was going on. That happens to me. And you know what I found out that day from that guy at my first meeting out of my detox with this crazy guy, Jimmy? I found out that the immense power that Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, represents to someone like me. Because you know what? We can say whatever we want about crazy Jimmy. He meant every word he said. The guy would have woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning. He would have gotten on his pants and gotten his keys. He would have gotten in his car. He would have driven to wherever I was on Staten Island. He would have picked me up. He would have brought me to the Unicorn Diner. And he would have sat there and listened to me throw up my problems until my desire and my urge to drink and use drugs passed. For free. For fun and for free. Where do you find that? Where do you find that? That's immense power of our fellowship. Huge. That guy keeps the lights on. That's the guy who does the service. Until I can have a 12-step experience, that's my guy. That's the guy who answers the call. That's the guy who goes and sits with you. That's the guy who picks up. I love that guy. And guys like him keep the lights on. In COVID, a lot of those folks kept the lights on. When everybody else went home, those guys came and they kept the lights on. And then they turned the lights back on for the ones that went out. I love the guys like Jimmy. This fellowship is massive power. Free. Available to every single person in this room. Unbelievable, immense power. I'm a fellowship guy. I'm a big book guy, no doubt. Page and verse, I'm a preacher. I love the big book. But God, I love our fellowship. This thing is so powerful, what we have. And Jimmy taught me that. Then the next day, I met my sponsor. The next meeting I went to was the Woodrow Big Book meeting on Staten Island. I met crazy Joey T-Bird. Joey was my personal Ebbie Thatcher. If you don't know who that is, it's Bill's first guy that came and presented a program of recovery to Bill, the six-step Oxford group program. Joe was my Ebbie because I used with him and I drank with him, and he and I went nuts together. And when I saw him in that meeting, I walked into a meeting. It's my second meeting out of detox, and I walk in and I see Joey T-Bird there. That sounds insane. My eventual home group was the Island of Misfit Toys, the craziest people you ever met in your life, leg breakers, mob guys, you name it. We had a collection of misfit toys in my home group. But I saw Joey T in there, and I'm like, oh. As soon as I saw him, I got like kind of that sick street happy, and I'm like, he's going to punch someone directly in the face. No question. He's probably drunk, and if not, I'm going to goad him. I'll goad the bear. I'll get Joey T started, because just to see the show, because again, I was a dick. And he, oh my God, was he different. Holy cow. He saw me and he came up to me and he was like, Richie, how's you? Good to see you, bro. And I was like, whoa. You know, you ever meet somebody again for a long time and you're like, oh my God. Like, he had changed in a way that I can't even, you want to talk about power. I shook his hand. I almost felt it. I was like, whoa. And no ranting, no preaching, no nothing. He gave me a small copy, a personal size copy of the big book. And he wrote his number in it. And he gave me a copy of the meeting list. Common Solution Group, 7:45, Thursday, be there. He's like, dude, you're going to see the guys that are there. You're going to know some of them from the neighborhood. He's like, you're not going to believe this meeting. It's phenomenal. Love to see you there. You got to get well, dude. You're sick. And he gave me his number, and he gave me the meeting list, and he circled it, and he said, I hope I see you there on Thursday. And he intrigued me, seeing a guy like Joe T. And that's where I went and got sober. I went and I met with that crew. And I went and I did service. And I was telling you before the meeting started, I still to this day, 26 years, and I got the coffee commitment in my home group. I'm too sick for the fancy commitments. My sponsor told me early days, you need to be in the kitchen. You're too sick for anything else. Scrub the pots, change the ashtrays, brooms and chairs. Those are the ABCs for me. So I fell in with a real home group of 12-step people. They're big book guys, Common Solution. And what does that mean? It means that I got Joey T and I asked him to sponsor me. And he sat down with me at his kitchen table one-on-one for 2 hours at a clip twice a week until I went through and completed the entire 12-step recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I followed every direction that he gave me, and I answered like a wise ass, and I went kicking and screaming, and I did not like it, and I don't think the steps were awesome, and I thought a lot of it sucked, and I hated writing my fourth step, but I did it all. I just went with him, and he walked me through, and he pulled me through, and he pushed me through, and my home group pushed me through, and they were a sick lot of people, and it takes a village, and they surrounded me, and every time I came in, they'd be like, where are you in the steps? Where are you in the steps? I do it to people now. People avoid me in my home group, because they know I'm going to say, how's your ninth step coming? Like, oh, I haven't made one. Oh, why not? And that's just what they did for me when I came in, because we pull you in. And so I did that, and I can tell you 1,000 stories. We don't have time. I was joking too. I could speak for 2 hours. I have so much stuff that's happened to me since I've come to this place. But what we realize when we come to impart to everybody our story, what is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous? There are watershed moments. I've had some sick stuff happen to me. Not all of it good. I've had some bad shit happen in recovery. I never saw a need to drink or use through it. I'll tell you that, which is incredible for someone like me, because I drink and use. That's what I do. I'm built to drink and use. I drink and use well. I'm an Olympic drinker and user. I loved to drink and use. Any newcomer, if you hear anybody up here telling you my best day sober, my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. Think about that. My worst day in sobriety is better than my best day drinking and using. Where did you drink and use? You know what I mean? I used to love partying and drinking and using until it almost killed me. Until it took from me, until I could no longer go back to that again, until the party was over, until I crossed the line, until it destroyed me and it ate who I was from the inside out. And I ended up in that apartment alone, booby trapping, because that's what it does to me. I lost the ability, and I lost the privilege of being able to do stuff that normal people can do, and I'll never get it back. And I see and recognize that now, because I had a real first step experience. So what changed it for me? I'll tell you, I know the moment that I got truly sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober for about 18 months, and I started sponsoring everybody. And I could talk. I'm a salesman, right? So they, oh, Richie, come speak. So I'm going, man, we go speak today. I'm going to speak. You know what I mean? Like ego. I'm going to speak. Tell my story. I'm sponsoring 9 people out of my home group, and I'm sharing my story everywhere. And then it was about 18 months in, and I got tired. All of a sudden, I don't know if anybody's ever gone through this. I used to love going to meetings. I love it. I felt good. People like, Richard, like cheers. I didn't want to go. One day I woke up and I wanted to don't drink, go to a movie. And then I don't drink, go to a movie again. And then I just decided not to drink. And then I decided I was going to take a break from meetings because it was taking a lot of my time. And now I had a real life, you know, I had a real life. So I had like real responsibilities and stuff to do. And then before you know it, you know, you're getting sick thoughts again. And I started having drinking drug dreams. Anybody have drinking drug dreams? It's an interesting thing, drinking drug dreams. There were people in our fellowship that told me, I wouldn't worry about that. It's the most normal thing in the world. My sponsor in my home group, when I did finally get honest with them that I was having drinking drug dreams, they're like, most normal thing in the world? That guy's an idiot. What are you talking about? God gave us. It's a warning. So danger, Will Robinson. Danger. You're fantasizing and romanticizing about something that would kill you and take everything from you, and you think that's normal? It's not normal. It's not okay for a drug addict and alcoholic to be fantasizing and romanticizing about drug use and alcohol use. It's not okay. It's dangerous. And having those dreams is dangerous. That's God's way of saying danger, danger. This is what they were telling me. So I went and met my sponsor. They kicked it upstairs. I had to go see. They sent me to Joe Red's office, you know? And I had to go see Joe Red. So I went and I thought a lot about it before I went to Joe Red's house, and I show up and I'm like, I said, so Joe, thanks for agreeing to see me. You know, I come walk into his house, so full of myself I was back then. And I walk in and I say, thanks for seeing me, I appreciate it. I said, I think I got it all figured. And he's like, oh, you do, huh? And I said, oh yeah, absolutely. I said, here's the problem. I stopped going to meetings. I know that's good. I'm going to change that right now. I'm going right back to meetings again for sure. I said, I stopped doing my 10-step work, so I wasn't being mindful of, you know, whatever, all the stuff you guys taught me, my dishonesty, fear, selfishness. I wasn't looking for all the stuff I'm supposed to look for. I got you. And I said, and then I wasn't writing my inventory, and those are the bookends, and I know I need that for spiritual health and growth, and then I got to start answering my sponsee calls again, because I was letting them go to voicemail so I could watch the Giants game. And then once I do that, I'm good. I'm right back to health, and everything is going to be fine. And I said, so, thanks for seeing me.
Yeah.
I literally took like 8 minutes soliloquy and I told him, thanks for seeing me and I appreciate it. And he did what all good sponsors and sponsors do, and he just shook his head and he said, you really are in, and that my life had become unmanageable. And I'm like, what do you mean? Didn't you just hear all the good shit I just said? And he was like, dude, you literally came here, asked for my help, sat down. All you did was talk. And now you're ready to leave because you figured it all out on your own. You're sick. Your life has become unmanageable and you are running the show. And I'm like, well, what did I miss? And he said, I mean, I'm just throwing it out there. I noticed that you didn't say anything about your 9-step events. Isn't that weird? And I said, oh, yeah, well, you would think that, but that's because I only have bullshit amends left. That's why I didn't mention it. And so my Joe Red was like, what's a bullshit amends? He's like, I don't know what that is. He's like, what does that mean? And I said, you know, the unimportant ones. And he said, well, what is an unimportant amends? And I said, you know, I stole a hair dryer from CVS when I was like 11. I don't know why. I didn't have long hair. I just like to steal shit. So I stole it. Oh, a hair dryer. It was like $4 hair dryer back in the day. One of those little mini ones. And I'm like, yeah, that's gonna set me off into, and so he said, stop right there, go home right now, get your, how many unfinished amends do you have? And I said, like 11. He's like, you have only 11 unfinished, but you're not doing them because they're bullshit. I said, yeah. He said, go home and get them right now. I lived close to him. He was on Quinlan Avenue. I ran back then. I was a great job. I ran to my house. I got him. I ran back to his house. I said, boom, 11 amends cards. Laid them all out. He looked at them all and he's going through them with me and I'm being a wise ass and I'm going, oh, there you go, Joe. That's a big one. Yeah. You know? Oh, I owe $12 to the A&P because I stole a ham or something out of there. And so I had all these specific financial amends. They were all little nonsense amends. And then being a wise guy, I found the one amends card and I said, oh, here it is, Joe. This is the one that's going to set me over. I was truly was a dick, even now to Joe, who was such a good guy, but I was just being a wise ass. And I said, this is the one, Joe. This is the one that's going to set me into it's going to make me free. And he's like, what is it? And I said, when I was a paper boy and I delivered the Staten Island Advance. You know what the paper boy does? And they still do that around here. You deliver like newspapers to people and then you go collecting and they give you like $2 or whatever. It was a great job to have as a little kid. And I wasn't drinking and using that. I was a kid. I was like 10, 11 years old. And I went to this nice family, the Dunn family, and I double collected from them. I lied to the husband and the wife. They were the best tippers on the route. Best people to steal from is your best tip, right? So I went, of course, they were great people to steal from, and I lied to the wife. And I made up some bullshit story, and I said, oh, I'm going away for 2 weeks, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, all right, Richard, no problem. She went in, it was $2.25 they would give me every week. And so she went in, and she gave me $4.50. And then the next week, because I'm so smart, I saw the husband out doing leaves or whatever, and I made up another story for him because, you know, they'll never talk. You know what I mean? They'll never suspect that I would do it. And I lied to him. And they never did say anything. And so I owed them $4.50 from overcollection. That's the thing, right? I'm going to get sober on $4 to the Dunn family. And so Joe, just patient as he ever was, he said, once again, you're missing the point. And he said, and you're forgetting one of the key things that you said in the beginning when you came in to get well and you started going through the steps with Joe T, you said that you were willing to go to any lengths. And, you know, willingness is a key thing for us and what we need to get recovered. And willingness has a sound, he told me. And I said, what? He said, it has a sound, willingness. And I said, what sound, Joe, does willingness make? That's the sound of willingness. You can be willing. I'm willing to make my amends. Knock on their door. That's the sound of willingness in Alcoholics Anonymous, is you going out and knocking on doors. Don't talk about it. Don't think about it. Be about it. Knock on these doors. Go to the A&P. Give them the $4. Give them the $3. You don't get to decide. You don't get to decide what's good for you, what's going to work, what's not going to work, what's important, what's unimportant. Who are you? You ruined your life. You're the worst manager of a baseball team in history. You're an 0-in-everything record. You don't win. All your possessions were in a garbage bag, and you're going to sit and tell me that now you know what's good for you? That's the problem. Self. Self-manifested in various ways will kill you. You don't know what's good for you. Follow directions. Stop being the boss. And I was like, fine, I'll go make the stupid amends. I'll give the Duns the $4.50. $20, right? Interest. They always made me pay interest. So he told me you have a week, and I went out and made those last 11 stupid amends to the A&P, to the CVS, whatever. And I went by the Dunn's house, and I had told Joe it was, you know, they'd never know who I was now and there. There's no way they still live there. You know what I mean? Like, this is forever ago. They're not going to still be at the house anyway. And I started going through all the reasons why. And what is all that for? It's fear. All of a sudden, I was afraid. So for 18 months, I'd made a ton of amends, sponsoring guys, speaking everywhere. All of a sudden, fear came back into my life, and I was scared to make my amends. What is that? That has no place. And so he said, it doesn't matter if they're there. Doesn't matter if they know you. Just go and knock on the door and see what happens. And so I went and knocked on all the doors, and I drove to the Dunn's house. Willingness doesn't sound like that for a kid like me. Willingness sounds like this. You know? Because if they don't answer, I'll drop that thing in the mailbox. Peace. You know what I mean? Universal amends. And so I light knocked, you know, nice and easy, and I swear to God, he must have called her, you know? And I know he didn't, but it felt like that, because the door opened right up. I look down, and I know it's her. She has silver hair now, but I know it's Mrs. Dunn. And I'm like, oh my God, it's her. And she looks up, and she's like, oh my God, it's Richie Heschen, the paper boy! And I'm like, no way! So I can't believe that she remembers me. She opens the screen door, and she's like, come in, come in! And I said, no. I said, no, I'm good. I don't want to go in her house. I just want to hit her up and get out of that because I'm already scared. And she said, nonsense. And she comes and hooks my arm, this little Irish Spitfire lady, and she pulls me in her living room. So I go into the living room, and who's laying on the couch but her gigantic husband? I didn't mention that in the beginning of the story. Have you ever met a mountainous Irishman? A 7-foot-tall basketball hand monstrous Irishman? That's that guy. And he stood up, and I felt like a little paper boy again. He's like, hello, Richard. I'm like, oh, hey, Mr. Dunn. And he shakes my hand, and I'm like, the two people I stole from all those years ago are now standing in front of me in their living room, and I'm 27 years old. Like, that's crazy, right? And I look at them both, and Mrs. Dunn goes, Tommy, Jimmy, Donna. And I'm like, no. She's calling the kids into the living room, and I'm like, oh, my God. She calls the kids. Sure enough, Tommy comes out of the kitchen. Jimmy, full-fledged stoner in my neighborhood, became a mailman, beard down to here, comes walking down the banister, gets halfway down, looks at me, totally baked out of his mind. What's up? I said, hey, what's up, Jim? And they're all looking at me, and Mrs. Dunn says, so what are you doing here? And they're all looking at me. What do you say, right? So I didn't know what to say, so I said what I was taught. And I said, well, you may or may not know this, but I'm a 12-step recovery program, victory over alcoholism. One of the things we do is make a list of people we'd harmed, and your name came on the list, and I lied to you, and I double-collected, and I owe you $4.50, and here's $20 with interest, and I'm sorry. And I look right down at my feet, and oh my God, dead silence. Dead silence in the house. And I'm looking down at my feet, and all of a sudden, I feel her, and I see, and her hand is on my chin, and she pulls me up so I could look her in the eyes. Man, normal people know that, the value of that. She makes me look her in the eyes, and she said, we knew those years ago, my husband and I, that you lied to us. And she said, we just figured maybe you and your family were going through a hard time and you needed the money. And so she let me steal from her and her family because they thought maybe me and my family were having a tough time. And I didn't even know there were really people like that in the world. I didn't know people would let you steal from them because they thought you were having a tough time. I'd never come across it, I don't think. Or maybe I just didn't pay enough attention. But that bullshit amends that I wasn't even going to make lit me up like a Christmas tree. Woof! I can't explain it. To this day, that ridiculous amend changed everything. She hugged me. Her monstrous husband hugged me. Her stoner son, the whole family is hugging me in the living room. You want to talk about God? Woof! I mean, my relationship with whatever that thing was that I just started opened me up like a can. It was unbelievable, the experience that gave me. I floated out of that house. I haven't wanted to drink or use since. Wasn't even going to make it. You know why? Because I know what's good for me. I know what's good for me and what I need to do, right? I don't know. I got to stop managing the show. That was the single most powerful watershed moment in my recovery. I wouldn't have even done it. But I don't get to decide, and I don't get to make up. And I'm going to share one more story before I cut off. And again, I could tell you a whole bunch of different stuff. And that's, you know, that one's serious. A lot of times I just end with that because it's such a watershed moment for my recovery. But something told me before I came tonight, and maybe it's somebody in here, I don't know. But I always trust my intuitive thought. And so this may seem a lot of place, but it just is. It's about our practice, what we do when we come in here. This is real, what we do. All the stuff I'm talking about, this is real life. Right? I'm not just, I can quote page and verse out of the big book. I can do it. I've read it 1,000 times. I can literally quote it like a preacher. Page 23 says, but, I know it all. I don't do that when I share because I like to share real life experience. But I like to remind everybody this stuff we do and that we talk about is real. Like it's a real thing. It's a way of life. It's a lifestyle that I've adopted. You guys taught it to me, and now I've learned it, and I've started practicing it for many years. But when I came in here, I wasn't good at it. Who starts playing the piano and can play Chopin? Who can do that? No one can do that. Well, maybe some people can do that, but not many people can do that. You have to practice. And so when I came in, I'm a natural born liar. I lie for sport. I don't know if I'm different than everybody here, but I love to lie. Back then, I would lie just for the sake of lying. I like to steal. I like to lie. Like, that was just part of who I was, and it's hard to get rid of that overnight. It takes practice. And so they got me up to the 10-step practice. And if anybody doesn't know what a 10-step is, a living, waking practice. It's real life. It's practical. It's a spiritual guidepost that I'm supposed to try and live my life by. And when I first was given the directions to practice the 10-step, I was told that you have to, Richie, from now on, watch for selfishness, dishonesty, fear, and resentment as they come up. And if they come up, you've got a thing you got to do. You got to pray on it. You got to share it with someone, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't good at it. And so I'm going out there, and I'm in AA, and I'm lying, and I'm doing whatever I do. And then they taught me to write inventory, so if I don't see that 10-step I miss, I catch it in my writings at night. Were you dishonest today? No. Were you resentful today? No. Were you selfish today? No. All my inventories. No, 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 no. I was perfect. I was a saint. I was just starting to do inventory. All of them were clean. My sponsor was like, really? Nothing? I'm like, he said, just keep trying. I prayed on it, and then one day, I had gone to a meeting that night, and I'm writing, dishonest, no. Selfish, no. And then I went, wait a minute. I was dishonest. At one of the meetings out front, there was a bunch of guys talking when I showed up. I don't know where this came. God showed it to me, I guess. And they were talking about a hockey game, the Rangers. High stick, this, that. And I want to be one of the guys. And so I went in. I'm like, yeah, yeah, that game was awesome. I hate hockey. I'm like, oh, I love that game. It was great. High stick, the check. And you say something and I repeat it like a little bit different way, a little 5 minutes into the conversation. And you think I know what's going on. I didn't hurt anybody. We all went into the meeting. We all went home. No big deal. But I saw it under my dishonesty. To fit in, I was lying to AA people about nonsense. And I saw it. So I called my sponsor. I'm like, dude, share my inventory with him. He's like, oh, you have something. I said, yeah, I was dishonest. I lied to Tommy T and blah, blah, blah. I told him. And he goes, dude, that's awesome. He's like, that's the beginning. That you're going to start to get sober. I said, great. He's like, all right, call Tommy T, tell him what you did, and then call me tomorrow. Let me know how it goes. And he hung up. And I'm like, it doesn't say that in the big book. So I got to call Tommy T. I'll make the short, fast ending. I called Tommy T. I got to tell him. I got to live different. That's lifestyle. I got to be honest that I lied to my AA friend. He answers the phone. I'm like, oh, my phone's 500 pounds. I said, Tommy, I got to talk to you, bro. He's like, O'Malley, what happened? And I said, remember when we were at the meeting and we were talking about that stupid hockey game? And he's like, yeah. And I said, dude, I lied. I didn't watch that game. I hate hockey, and I don't know why I did that, and I'm sorry. Dead silence again on the phone. Dead silence. And it went on for 10 seconds. 10 seconds is a long time. And at first, I felt stupid, and then I'm like, is this kid kidding me or what? I mean, it's not like I blew up his car. It's not that big of a deal, you know? As the silence drags on, I'm starting to get pissed now, you know? Like, you're going to make me suffer through it? Like, aren't you supposed to say, don't worry about it, you'll grow? He didn't do that. He just total silence. So I'm sitting there, and then I hear him. And he goes, O'Malley? And I said, yeah. He goes, I didn't see that game either. Oh, I was pissed. That's my 4th step come to life. And now I'm pissed at him. I'm like, you lied to me? The very thing I was mad and I did. He did it to me. It's different when you do it to me. When I do it to you, it's understandable. When you do it to me, you're a dick. And so I start now getting mad at Tommy. And then we both start laughing at ourselves. And the reason I like to tell that particular story and that kind of story is to remind everybody, you're not alone. None of us does this thing perfect. And we're going to make mistakes and we're going to screw up. And we are an island of misfit toys. And when one of us is doing badly, one of us will be on fit spiritual ground. And if you're in a good home group and you've got a good collection of misfit toys that are really trying to live different, I think we can get through this thing together one day at a time. So thank you.